And then I folded it up, put it back on the newsstand, because if we weren't in it, I wasn't going to buy it. Couldn't afford $1.75. And we were on the front page of the Washington Post Sunday edition. You do what you do for 5 years, and then God put us on the map.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Hello, and welcome to The Profile with me, AJ. The Profile is a chance to sit down and talk to a well-known Christian about their faith, work, and dig a little deeper into their life story. Today, on the show, I'm speaking to Mark Batterson, author of the New York Times bestseller, The Circle Maker, Praying Circles Around Your Biggest Dreams and Greatest Fears. In this conversation, we touch on everything from the theology of failure to healthy and biblical ambition. Without any further ado, let's get into this conversation. Mark, take me all the way back to the beginning. What was growing up like for Mark Batterson?
Born in 1969, I just am putting my age out there right away. So grew up 70s, 80s, Midwest, Chicago area, and grew up in a pretty idyllic environment. Mom and dad, one brother, and just grateful for growing up in church, although I would say went to a lot of different kinds of churches. I'm a denominational mutt in terms of the different churches that I went to growing up. But sports early on, played basketball in college, big part of my life. But then eventually felt called to ministry. And for the past 30 years, my wife and I have led a church starting with 19 people, National Community Church right here in Washington, D.C., of course, our nation's capital.
That is the first time I've heard that phrase, the denominational mark. So is it safe to say you've been a Christian all your life?
Yeah, there was a moment at 5. We went to see a Billy Graham film called The Hiding Place, the story of Corrie ten Boom. And it was after watching that movie that I asked my mom if I could ask Jesus into my heart. And so that was me putting my 5-year-old faith in Jesus. And kind of fun, you know, I think we tend to want to reach other people the way that we were reached. So a movie literally changed my life. And what a joy recently to get a first film credit on the David animated film that just came out last year. And got to be an advisor on that film. And so I love pastoring. I love writing. But I love movies, too. I think they have a unique capacity to impact us in a way that maybe is beyond a traditional sermon or book.
You said you are a big sports fanatic and you play sports as well. And you felt called to ministry. Tell me more about that journey from sports into pastoring.
Well, I didn't play big league basketball. The NBA was not recruiting me. I was a first team All-American, but it was the NCAA. The extra C stands for Christian. So amongst Christian universities and colleges, let's just say I had some game. And I played above the rim, but 6 knee surgeries later, I hung up the basketball sneakers right after college. And there was a moment. I was actually at the University of Chicago on scholarship. I was a pre-law major, politics, economics, rhetoric, and law. And at the end of my freshman year, I prayed a dangerous prayer. Lord, what do you want me to do with my life? So I would say up until that point, I really had invited Jesus to follow me, which is very different than me following him. It was more about God serving my purposes than me serving his. But that was my all-in moment, the moment that whenever, wherever, whatever. And I felt a call to full-time ministry. So I gave up that scholarship, transferred to a Bible college, and pursued ministry. Ended up going to seminary And actually, our first attempt at church planting was a failure in the Chicago area, but that's how we ended up in DC. So looking back on it, I'm grateful for it. And that's a little bit of the journey, kind of the winding road that got us here to DC.
I wanted to get into this a little bit later, but your book, your latest book, touches on that sort of aspect, like gradually then suddenly. And it sounds like you experienced that in your pastoring very early. What was that like?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, the first few years of planting and pastoring, nothing easy about it. Took about 5 years to grow from a core group of 19 people to a church of about 250 people. And so 5 years of plowing and planting and just trying to do the right things. I will say this, I think a critical moment, August 16, 1996, about 8 months into planting, I felt prompted to pray a circle around Capitol Hill, turned into a 4.7-mile prayer walk. And we now own 7 properties on that prayer circle, which you just can't make that up. And I wasn't praying for property. I was just praying for people. Lord, let your kingdom come. Your will be done in D.C. as it is in heaven. But God has blessings in categories we can't conceive of. God is always writing a bigger story. And so it's pretty amazing all these years later. Those 7 properties on that prayer circle. I think prayer is how we write history before it happens. And so we're kind of living in the fulfillment of a lot of answered prayers. And so those first 5 years, I will share one thing. The turning point was really a news article that was written about the church. We kind of flew under the radar for 5 years, and then a reporter asked if they could interview me. They found it curious that we were 80% single 20-something, so very young, very single, and that was a little bit of an anomaly 30 years ago. And so they said, we want to do an article. They said it might make the religion section. And so on August 12, 2001, I pick up the newspaper, and I was a little disappointed because we didn't make the religion section. And then I folded it up, put it back on the newsstand, because if we weren't in it, I wasn't going to buy it. Couldn't afford $1.75. And we were on the front page of the Washington Post Sunday edition. And it was really one of those suddenly moments where you do what you do for 5 years, and then God put us on the map. And that next year, we doubled in size. It was just one of those days when decades happen. And God has a way. If you do the right thing day in and day out, God has a way of showing up and showing off. And if you do little things like they're big things, God has a way of doing big things like they're little things. So that's how I would kind of summarize some of those early years and some of those defining moments.
One of those days when decades happen is a fantastic saying. Let's get back to that. What were some of the challenges you encountered in those 5 years and the biggest lessons you drew from them?
In the early years, our first attempt at church planting failed, and it was incredibly embarrassing, discouraging. But here is the big lesson I learned. The cure for the fear of failure is not success. It's failure in small enough doses that you build up an immunity to it. And you discover that God's there to pick you up, dust you off, give you a second chance. And so I really am grateful for that failed church plant, because that's how we got from Chicago to D.C. And I would say a second lesson is, unless the Lord builds the house, we labor in vain. So it's by definition, a God-sized dream is going to be beyond your ability, beyond your resources, beyond your education. You can't do it, but God can. And when he does, he'll get the glory by doing something you can't take credit for. So that is one of those early lessons. And I would say a second lesson is, do things twice your size. And what I mean by that is this: you got to stretch your faith. You have to do things that you have to dare to dream in a way that it's destined to fail unless God shows up. And we've had a few of those moments where you step out in faith and then see God deliver in some pretty amazing ways.
Was there anything in particular that you can look back retrospectively and point to as the reason that the first church plant didn't work out?
You know what? I really can't. It's past my pay grade. I don't know why. I don't know if it was just the wrong place, the wrong time. I will share this, that I have something called a Deuteronomy 29:29 file. And that little verse says the revealed things belong to us. The secret things belong to God. And so when things happen that I don't understand, that may not make sense on this side of eternity, I put them in that Deuteronomy 29:29 file. And it's that file, when you get older, it gets pretty full, AJ. So, you know, I feel like there are a lot of things I don't understand. Why that first church plant failed, why I lost a father-in-law in the prime of life, prime of ministry at 55 years of age. Like, I don't understand it. You know, there's a lot of things I don't understand, but that's where trust comes into play. And at the end of the day, even when I can't see God's hand, I've learned to trust his heart.
Around this time in your 20s, when you would have been answering the call to ministry, you also felt called to write, correct?
Yes. Yeah.
Tell me about that season.
Yeah. Well, I felt called to write at 22. I just started seminary. And the irony is that I had just taken the graduate record exam, GRE, and it showed a low aptitude for writing. In other words, whatever you do, don't write books. Don't inflict that on the world. So writing for me is not a natural gifting. But I'll tell you what I did. I read 3,000 books before I wrote one. And it took about 13 years. And finally, at 35, published that first book. And so I think some of us feel like our weaknesses are where God cannot use us. But the last time I checked, God's power is made perfect in weakness. And he certainly gave us our strengths. He gave us our gifts and our abilities. He wants to use us in those places. But I've also learned that God loves using us at a place of weakness. And so when I sit down at a keyboard and write, I don't just type with 26 letters of the English alphabet. I really feel like I worship God with those 26 letters. And I take my shoes off when I write because I feel like it's holy ground. And so for me, writing is a weak hand exercise, but somehow, some way, God has put about 10 million books into people's hands. And I don't see a book sold as a book sold. I see it as a prayer answered. Lord, put the right book in the right hands at the right time. And so God has done that more times than I would have imagined at 22.
3,000 books in 13 years is nuts. I did the math. That's 230 books a year. I have two questions.
Yes.
How? And why?
Yes, yes. The how is we didn't have smartphones way back when. And, you know, the average person spends about 2 hours and 24 minutes on social media every day. Do you know how many books you can read if you put about 2 hours and 24 minutes into reading every day? About 230 books a year, AJ. You know, you can. So I think what's happened is the world has changed so dramatically. And I don't read at that kind of pace or volume anymore. I mean, I still read a lot because I love books, but I was incredibly disciplined and just made a habit. And I really read across the board. I think all truth is God's truth. Every ology is a branch of theology. Albert Einstein said, never lose a holy curiosity. And so I love everything from astrophysics to neuroanatomy. It doesn't make me an expert in any of those subjects, but I love exploring in that way. And Romans 1:20 says that God reveals his invisible qualities, his divine power and eternal nature through the things that he has made. So that's the how. And the why really is a holy curiosity. I don't know. There's hardly anything that I'm not interested in. I find almost everything fascinating. And so it wasn't too hard for me to read pretty extensively. And so whether it's science or history or anything in between, I love to learn. And I think that's part of loving God with all of your mind. It's using some of that capacity that God's given us to continue to grow and learn. And the last thing I'll say about that is this: the more you know, the more you know how much you don't know. And so I really think true knowledge leads to a certain level of humility and curiosity, and it kind of feeds that hunger to keep learning.
That 13-year gap between when you sense the call to actually walking in it, that to where you'll see produce from it. Did you ever struggle with the idea that you were behind, or the doubt that you were where you were supposed to be? Because that can come in situations like that.
Yeah, 100%. In fact, about 10 or 11 years into it, I was so frustrated. I started to despise my birthday because it felt like an annual reminder of a dream deferred. I mean, I was like, why did you call me? And it doesn't seem like I can write a book. And I think what the Lord was doing was allowing me to acquire some failures, some scars, some disappointments, so that it wasn't a theoretical book that I was writing when I finally wrote it. It was coming out of life experience. And so a lot of discouragement, and it's hard. That's when you got to kind of hold on to, hey, I really do think that God has called me. You know, I started blogging, so I would exercise kind of my writing muscles. I would start turning sermons into what I called evotionals, devotional without the D. And so I was exercising that writing gift, but I did not get a book into print until I was 35. And so discouraging at times, but I think the reality is most of us overestimate what we can accomplish in a year or two, but we underestimate what God can do in 10 or 20 or 30. And so even though it took 13 years to write the first book, I've written 27 books since then. And so that's a little more than a book a year while pastoring a church. And I think part of it, AJ, is that I was banking hours. I was banking books. I was banking ideas. And all of those were the seedbed that now just keeps kind of paying dividends. It's almost like compound interest on those 3,000 books and on the life experience. And God continues to use it.
Looking back, again, it all goes back to the gradually and suddenly. What do you feel like instant success would have taken away from you had you experienced it as soon as you sensed that call?
Yeah. Well, I think sometimes if success comes too quickly or too easily, you might be tempted to think that you had a little bit more to do with it than you did. And you tend to take a little bit more credit. I think that God was laying foundation. And I will say this, even though at times I was a little frustrated, both on the pastoring side and on the writing side, I look back on it now and I'm like, I don't want to take shortcuts. I don't want any cheat codes. I don't want it to come easy because I think then there's really no foundation even now. So we have the joy of hosting the Easter sunrise at the Lincoln Memorial on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. And it's an epic celebration of the resurrection. And many, many thousands of people show up. But I'll tell you what, I remember our first Easter when we had 43 people. And I was over the moon because we had never broken 30, let alone 40. And so I look back on life, and you always want things to happen faster. In fact, I would say that a lot of people now want twice what their parents had in half the time. We want it yesterday. But I think we want things to happen at the speed of light, but they still happen at the speed of a seed that has to be planted in the ground, that has to take root before it can bear fruit. So the reality is, I think success still happens at the speed of Eden and the speed of a seed. So that's kind of the story, our story. I know that there are people that maybe have been experienced success a little bit quicker, but Sam Walton, the guy who started Walmart, is famous for saying that it took 20 years to become an overnight success. And I think most people, whatever it is that they do, identify with that because it takes time and patience. But that's where long obedience in the same direction comes into play.
Hi, it's Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity magazine. I'm proud to say we are celebrating our 60th anniversary. From our beginnings as Buzz in the 1960s to the vibrant multi-platform magazine we are today, our commitment to connecting faith with the world around us has never changed. To mark the occasion, we have a special offer of 12 months for half price. That's just £24 for print and digital access. Subscribe today at premierchristianity.com. Automatically renews at £47.99.
A couple minutes ago, you mentioned God has dreams and what that looks like for you. I wanted to ask about how you can tell the difference between ambition that is grounded in faith and ambition that is self-serving.
Yeah. Well, AJ, I'll shoot straight and share my experience that early on when I was much younger, there were certain stages that I really wanted to speak on. And I have since learned if I really wanted them that bad, I wasn't ready for them. In fact, that was my ego that was kind of talking to me. And so even now, if I'm speaking at a conference or in an environment, if I get nervous, usually that's my ego, that I'm more concerned about what people think about me, their opinions of me, than just using whatever gifts God's given to me and doing it for the applause of nail-scarred hands. And so I think ego is the enemy. You got to check your ego at the door. You got to put your ego on the altar every single morning. Otherwise, those selfish motivations are going to get into the mix. And here's the thing that keeps me grounded. You can do the will of God and God can oppose it because God opposes the proud. And so if you're doing the right thing for the wrong reasons, God can't fully bless it because your pride is going to get in the way. The good news is if you humble yourselves, then God has a way of showing favor that is above and beyond anything that we can take credit for. So that's kind of some of my internal processing as I think about what is, I think, a really important question for leaders to ask themselves.
Speaking of leading, we mentioned that you pastor a church, but you also do quite a lot of other things. Like you're wearing the Ebenezer's Coffee House hat now. You act as the lead visionary for the National Community Church. How would you describe your role and what it entails?
I love the verse that says, "Behold, I do a new thing." I like new things, AJ. There's something about one of our core convictions is there are ways of doing church no one's thought of yet. And there's something about leveraging imagination, which is part of the Imago Dei, and doing things a little different. And so you brought up Ebenezer's. I might as well touch on that. You know, why would a church build a coffee house on Capitol Hill? Well, I guess the first thing I would say is the Holy Spirit plus caffeine equals awesome. I think we could start right there. But I would also say this, that it's part of our philosophy of ministry. Jesus didn't just hang out in the synagogue. He hung out at wells. Wells were natural gathering places in ancient culture. Coffee houses are postmodern wells. And so we thought, let's create a place where church and community can cross paths. And so, and then every penny of profit we give to kingdom causes that we care about. And so I think there's a way to do business as mission. And then we've kind of extrapolated on that with really all of the buildings or facilities that we have. For example, our church campus on Capitol Hill is it's a city block, about 100,000 square feet. And we use it for house of prayer on Thursday nights. We use it for worship on the weekend. But we also host about 150 rental events that revenue stream about $2 million a year. And what it allows is for us to be a blessing to our community. And if it's a ministry, if it's another church or a nonprofit, we let them come in and use it for free. If it's a business or a corporate event, then we'll take your money and we'll leverage it for higher purposes. And so I think it's about thinking outside the box, daring to be just a little different. And honestly, that's part of taking our cues from Jesus. I mean, he broke a lot of rules, a lot of religious rules. He ate with sinners, touched lepers, celebrated Samaritans. He kind of colored outside the lines. And so I think what we've tried to do is dream just a little outside the box. How can we reach people that might not darken a church door? And sometimes if you want to reach unconventional people, you have to do some unconventional things.
Because of your emphasis on the slow process, like the real process in which failure is necessary, is needed. Is there any sort of failure that you feel like is unacceptable or that you shy away from?
Yeah. I mean, the easy answer is moral failure. My heart is grieved because there have been so many high profile failings and fallings in recent years amongst spiritual leaders. And the thing I would say is that in too many instances, the church has let celebrity culture in the front door. And if you put people on a pedestal, you're setting them up to fail because the human spirit can't handle that. And so I just, more and more, the longer I lead, I just want to make much of Jesus. I'm a sinner in need of a savior like everybody else. And so I think you've got to stay grounded. You've got to stay humble. It's okay to fail by trying something different or trying something new, but we got to have the character and the integrity to make sure that there's a foundation, that we aren't failing on the moral front, that we, you know, one of my values is I want to be famous in my home. Well, it's hard to be famous in your home if you're never home. To me, success is when those who know you best respect you most. That's my wife and my three kids and now two grandchildren. Like I listen, that's the end game, the end goal. Having your integrity intact at the end of it, and And so just a word of exhortation there. I think we want to guard ourselves against that kind of failure.
That's what I wanted to go next, because you have three children, and you just mentioned two grandchildren as well. But you do a lot. Have you found it hard to find that balance with that splitting your time between your loved ones and what you do in your work and ministry?
Yeah, it's, you know, over 30 years, I've probably made some mistakes there that I regret. I mean, there was a moment that my wife said to me, this isn't what I signed up for. I mean, I was going in too many directions. But this is where someone listening right now needs this. You've got to reestablish some holy and healthy boundaries. And so, you know what I did after that really hard conversation with my wife is I said, I'm not going to do more than 12 overnight speaking trips a year. And then I dialed it back to 7 because I want to make sure that my family gets the best of me, not the rest of me. And I want to make sure that I'm prioritizing, but you have to make pre-decisions. And those are the decisions you make before you make the decision. So knowing that I have certain boundaries in place, that I won't do more than 7 overnight speaking trips, and I won't sit simultaneously on more than 3 boards. Because I know if I overextend, I'm going to get into trouble. And then you have to guard the Sabbath as well. And that's not easy to do, because we live in such a 24/7 cycle of life. But you've got to find a way to unplug, to do a disappearing act. Jesus withdrew, Mark 1:35. And so we've got to find ways to step back, scale back, have some kind of equilibrium. And there are going to be seasons where you press and push. You know, Easter for us is a really heavy lift, but then you've got to make up for it after the fact and make sure that you rest and recover. Elite athletes, what they're best at is rest and recovery. They work out really, really hard, but then they're really, really good at rest and recovery. And I think spiritual leaders could probably learn a thing or two from elite athletes.
We've spoken quite a bit about the tragedy and then suddenly and the emphasis on the tragedy, but I want to know, what was your biggest suddenly moment back when you look back, or even if it's happening now, what has been your biggest suddenly moment where you saw God bring everything that you've been working towards to fruition?
Wow. Well, there are a couple of moments. There are a couple of moments. You know, it would have been the 6th book that I wrote. And the first 5 did great. But the 6th book, The Circle Maker, I mean, that book has sold millions of copies. I would have never imagined that it would make the kind of noise that it did. And I'm grateful it wasn't the first book or the 2nd or the 3rd. The reality is, you have to be really careful that you do what you do, not for extrinsic reasons. I really write because I'm called to write and try to do it because I love to write and I feel like I'm honoring God with that gift. So you got to keep doing it for the intrinsic reasons. And then on the church front, you know, it was, the reality, AJ, is that we met in rented facilities for 20 years, 20 years in rented facilities. So when we finally got a city block, 100,000 square feet, we do not take it for granted. In fact, but it happened suddenly. It was just, it was a crazy, crazy moment. And it's pretty crazy thinking about building buying a $29.3 million piece of property. I don't know how that currency translates, but that was, we didn't have a category for it, but the miracle was in the house. We now own it debt-free. And when God gives a vision, he has a way of making provision. It might not happen overnight, but again, there are suddenly moments. And so maybe one way to think about it, if I can get theological for a moment, we live forward, but God works backwards. We are God's workmanship created in Christ Jesus to do good works prepared for us in advance, Ephesians 2:10. So when the disciples were climbing the stairs to the upper room, they were counting up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. AJ, I think God was counting down 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, day of Pentecost. I think the same thing with Jericho. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, nothing. But God was counting down 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and those walls come tumbling down. So I live with a sense of destiny, really believing that God does work all things together for good. That God really is ordering our footsteps. I'm not naive. I know that bad things happen to good people. I know that theodicy, why is there so much pain and suffering in the world if God is all good and all powerful? I understand that. Those are hard questions. And I don't know exactly where the sovereignty of God and the free will of man meet. But I do believe that God is always at work, always setting us up, and has a way of preparing those good works that if we're obedient, we'll step into them and we'll experience the faithfulness of God.
That's a very healthy way of looking at destiny. But then there's also the reverse of that, where your destiny is tied to outcomes, and that's the journey.
Yes.
Can you talk about how it goes wrong when that's the case? And
Yeah. Thanks for bringing that up. So I said this on Easter Sunday, life is unfair, then we die. None of us is getting out of here alive. All of us are going to end up like Mary at the tomb weeping. We don't believe in happily ever after. We believe in something bigger and better and longer and stronger. We believe in happily forever after. So the only way that the multivariable calculus of life works is when you bring eternity into the equation. We live in a fallen world. We were born on a battlefield between good and evil. Every single day things happen that grieve the heart of God. But that's where we have a wider angle lens, and we're not aiming at time, we're aiming at eternity. And that's not a platitude. I really do believe the day is coming, Revelation 21, where God will wipe away our tears. There'll be no more mourning or crying or pain. And between now and then, our job is pretty simple. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. We're praying, Lord, let heaven invade earth. Let eternity invade time. And so that really is our job as salt and light, as those who represent Jesus and his kingdom. And I'll tell you what it looks like. It looks like loving your enemies, praying for those who persecute you, blessing those who curse you, turning the other cheek, going the extra mile, and giving the shirt off of your back. That's what God has called us to.
Another part of your book that you touch on is the idea of legacy and what that means to you. And your idea is your legacy is what others accomplish because of you. So the positions that you put other people in.
Yep.
Where does that come from?
You know, I think it comes from a few places. Biblically speaking, he's the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We tend to think right here, right now, God is thinking nations and generations. God is always writing a bigger story. But I would say on a personal level, AJ, I had a father-in-law that planted and pastored a church for 30 years. And I had a front row seat to long obedience in the same direction. And I would say that almost anything and everything God has done in or through National Community Church is really a testament to Calvary Church in Chicago that my father-in-law planted. That's the seedbed I come out of. Edgar Allan Poe wrote a poem in 1849. It said, it's all that we see or seem, but a dream within a dream. And so I would say all of us are a dream within a dream. In fact, if we were sitting down to lunch, maybe fish and chips, I would ask you the question. I would say, AJ, who left their fingerprints on your soul? And I would begin the conversation that way, because I want to know who influenced you, because you are their legacy. And Paul said as much. He said, you are the letter that we're writing. And so I think legacy is not buildings. It's not books. I think legacy is people's lives that you've somehow touched and influenced and encouraged and inspired in some form or fashion. And I think what's amazing is very few people will influence millions of people, but all of us can influence one person who might influence millions of people. And so I think it's about just being faithful in the sphere of influence that God's given us and continuing to really love in a way that will leave that kind of legacy.
Mm-hmm. So whose legacy are you?
It's a lot of people, but right at the top of the list would probably be my grandfather, Elmer Johnson. Died when I was 6 years old, but his prayers did not die. Some of my earliest memories are hearing him pray for me by name. And he couldn't hear himself because he was hard of hearing, but everybody else in the house could hear him praying. And there have been moments in my life where I feel like where the Holy Spirit has literally said in that still small voice, Mark, the prayers of your grandfather are being answered in your life right now. And so I think all of us are kind of a unique combination of people that influenced us. In fact, all of us, with a degree of frequency, probably experienced blessings we did nothing to deserve. And those are often the moments that someone else's faithfulness or fruitfulness is paying dividends in your life.
Is there anything in this moment, after essentially a life of the gradually and then suddenly, that you're currently waiting for, that in this moment, are you in a gradually right now?
Yeah, there's always, I dare say everybody has a gradually. There's someone you're praying for, but that prayer has not been answered yet. I'm going to keep going to the altar. And sometimes I go to the altar and I don't know what to pray. I'll just cry. But Charles Spurgeon said, tears are liquid prayers. And so there are people I'm praying for. And then there are dreams. You know, I what a joy to be a little piece of that David film. But I've got a couple of screenplays that we've been shopping for years. And believing that they'll end up on the big screen, but they haven't happened yet. But I'm patient. It took 13 years to write a book. It might take a little bit longer than that to make a movie. But I'm trusting that God's the one who put that passion in my heart. And I'll keep working it out and praying it out and trust God's timing in between.
Thank you very much for your time, Mark. This has been a major conversation.
Well, what an absolute joy and privilege and grateful.
That was Mark Basson talking to me, AJ, on The Profile. For more great interviews and stories from Christians across all walks of life, you can find The Profile on Premier Plus or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening, and until next time.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.